From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
It was the first time that it had hosted kind of black performing artists specifically. And I didn't know anything about this festival, and I was in the Lincoln Center archives reading about them and found out that the festival was produced by a fellow named Ellis Hazlip, who was a Washington, D.C. native, and I've been living in D.C. for 20 years now. And so I was really curious about this guy, Ellis Hazlip. He wrote a remarkable producer's note that was in the programs for this Lincoln Center festival that he had co-produced. And so I wanted to find out more about him. And I found out that he was a really significant, let's just say, cultural impresario of black performing artists, kind of across the board, all different arts, in the starting from the 1960s, 1970s, and, you know, into the 1980s. But that among the, you know, signal achievements of his career had been producing the first national television show to highlight black performing arts.
Dr. Gail Wall, professor of English and American Studies at George Washington University and author of It's Been Beautiful, Soul and Black Power Television, published by Duke University Press. Soul on public television from 1968 to 1973 was the only national TV show dedicated to culture and political expression of black power. In her new book, Wall examines Soul as an archive of feeling, discusses its strategies of connecting African-American performers to African-American audiences, examines its social and historical conditions of possibility and eventually demise, and explore what it means to think of black television outside of debates about representation. Soul was where Stevie Wonder and Earth, Wind & Fire got funky, where Toni Morrison read from her debut novel, where James Baldwin and Nikki Giovanni discussed gender and power. I'm Johnny L. Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, It's Been Beautiful, Soul and Black Power Television with Dr. Gail Wall in Black America.
So the idea for Soul had been in the works in the early part of 1968. Mm-hmm. Soul ends up getting its funding in the spring of 1968. Of course, Martin Luther King is assassinated in April of 1968, and the Kerner Commission report also comes out that spring, very close to the time of the assassination. So there's this kind of traumatic event that's resonating nationally and internationally, and also the report that you mentioned that the Johnson administration had commissioned to investigate uprisings that had happened in the mid-60s and in 1967. So these things are kind of coming together at the same time. And the Kerner Commission report had found that black people were not represented on television. And the Kerner Commission tried to make a connection between being represented on television and feeling like you were part of the citizenry, and suggested that if black people and their stories of black people were excluded from television, that black citizens were never going to feel that they were recognized as citizens.
From 1968 to 1973, the public television program Soul brought a who's who of African-American artists, writers, politicians, activists, actors, thinkers, and musicians to television screens across America. Viewers saw Toni Morrison read from her debut novel, Jane Baldwin chat with Nikki Giovanni and Earth, Wind & Fire in their early live performance, among many other noteworthy interviews and appearances. Produced by WNED, later by WNET, the show first reached audiences in its home market of New York City and then a national viewership via PBS distribution. In her book, It's Been Beautiful, Dr. Gail Wall examined Soul, the first African-American variety show on public television, which was instrumental in expressing the diversity of African-American culture, thought, and politics, as well as helping to create the nation of American community. Soul offered viewers radical ways of imagining, of hearing, feeling, and seeing black community. Musically speaking, Soul diffused the division of African-American art into high and low culture. Recently, In Black America spoke with Dr. Gail Wall.
When I was finishing a biography of the gospel singer Rosetta Tharpe around 2005, Rosetta Tharpe's last major appearance was at Lincoln Center in New York City in 1972 at a festival at a 10-day festival of black performing arts at Lincoln Center called Soul at the Center. And I'd never heard of this performing. It was the first time that Lincoln Center, which was pretty recently built in the early 70s, it was the first time that it had hosted kind of black performing artists specifically. And I didn't know anything about this festival, and I was in the Lincoln Center archives reading about them and found out that the festival was produced by a fellow named Ellis Hazlip, who was a Washington, D.C. native, and I've been living in D.C. for 20 years now. And so I was really curious about this guy, Ellis Hazlip. He wrote a remarkable producer's note that was in the programs for this Lincoln Center festival that he had co-produced. And so I wanted to find out more about him. And I found out that he was a really significant, let's just say, cultural impresario of black performing artists, kind of across the board, all different arts, in the starting from the 1960s, 1970s, and, you know, into the 1980s. But that among the, you know, signal achievements of his career had been producing the first national television show to highlight black performing arts. And that was a show called Soul that was on public television between 1968 and 1973. And he was the producer and really the visionary behind that show.
Obviously, when I ran across the title of the book and being a child of that period, who actually had an opportunity to see most of the episodes, I was really excited and enthralled that you had taken the time to look into this. When you decided to write this book, what was your first step?
The first thing I wanted to know was where I could get my hands on episodes. How much of this could I see? Mm-hmm. And the answer to that question is kind of the same as when I started the research, which is that the show is not commercially available and has really limited visibility on YouTube, although right, things go up here and there, and so your listeners can go to YouTube. Now, you can see about 9 or 10 episodes of the show that are streaming on the Channel 13 website. Channel 13 is the main public broadcasting outlet in New York City. And so you can go to Channel 13's website and see some episodes. So the first question was, what's out there? It turns out that not all the episodes of the show have survived. The right, first season, which was local, so it only aired in New York City, and it aired for more than 30 episodes. They did, you know, every week for most of the year. With those tapes were erased or lost or thrown out. Probably they were taped over or just thrown out at some point. And that was something that happened to these big tapes that people used back in the 60s. So the first question was, what's out there? And then the second question was, can I figure out who was on this show, and although the book doesn't incorporate interviews primarily, I talked to probably about 30 people mm-hmm. who had been involved in some way with the show, including some performers, but mostly with the people who worked behind the scenes, producers, secretaries, booking agents, and it's a remarkable group of people, really, many of whom got kind of their first experience in television through the show. And Ellis Hazlip was a wonderful mentor to kind of up-and-coming, not only performing artists, but also just kind of cultural professionals, like people who were going to work in radio or television or film or be writers. And this show employed also, I was really interested to find out, a huge number of black women. So Hazlip was, you know, kind of the main guy, but the office that he was running was primarily black women. So it was really interesting to me as a workplace as well. And then the roster of people who were on this show and the visionary things that the show did in ways that I don't think have really been repeated, you know, then I wanted to know about that. But the first thing was to find out what was on this show.
Besides talking about the show, you give the reader a history lesson exactly what was evolving during that period in history, and explain to our audience somewhat Soul was born out of the Kernel Commission report of the civil unrest that went on in 1968, and with the lack of African Americans having a presence on television. Tell our audience how soul kind of mirrored what was happening in society at that time.
Sure. Soul got its funding. So the idea for Soul had been in the works in the early part of 1968. Mm-hmm. Soul ends up getting its funding in the spring of 1968. Of course, Martin Luther King is assassinated in April of 1968, and the Kerner Commission report also comes out that spring, very close to the time of the assassination. So there's this kind of traumatic event that's resonating nationally and internationally, and also the report that you mentioned that the Johnson administration had commissioned to investigate uprisings that had happened in the mid-60s and in 1967. So these things are kind of coming together at the same time. And the Kerner Commission report had found that black people were not represented on television. And the Kerner Commission tried to make a connection between being represented on television and feeling like you were part of the citizenry, and suggested that if black people and their stories of black people were excluded from television, that black citizens were never going to feel that they were recognized as citizens. There are some, I think there were some, in retrospect, we can have some critiques of what the Kerner Commission was exactly saying, because I think it too easily, for me at least, and I mm-hmm. think probably some of the producers of the show also would agree. For me, one of the problems with the formulation of that report was that it equated kind of a superficial visibility right. with inclusion. It mm-hmm. didn't talk as much about changing, the modes of the who was behind the image. It was mm-hmm. kind of more about, well, if we put a black man on the news reading the weather report, that will habituate white viewers to kind of understanding black people as part of the polity. But it didn't really go far enough. Nevertheless, it was an important statement in 1968 because it really, as a statement from the federal government, and even though President Johnson didn't accept many of the commissioner's recommendations, it was a statement that empowered liberal broadcasters to go ahead with, in some cases, projects that they were already working on, and in some cases, to kind of get their acts together very quickly and use that report in order to spur new initiatives in broadcasting.
Right.
So it was important in that regard.
Ellis happened to be in the right place at the right time, knowing the right person. You talked about Christopher in your book.
Yeah, so he was a friend of one of the people who worked on cultural TV shows mm-hmm. at Channel 13 Public Broadcasting in New York City. And this was a white man, Kit, he goes by the nickname Kit
right.
Lucas, Christopher Lucas. And he had initially proposed a show for funding. He had an idea of a kind of Black Tonight show, a kind of variety show that would be serious, but that
right.
would kind of serve New York City residents. And they, he, especially after King's assassination, people at Channel 13 realized that they couldn't do this show without having black producers. They could no longer do shows about black people that were produced by white people. And so they went looking for someone. Now, of course, black people had been so excluded from television that it's not like you could find someone with television experience in 1968. So Ellis Hazlett primarily had developed his career in the world of theater. And he produced concerts, say, for the dancer Alvin Ailey. So he was involved in kind of the world, the performing arts world, but not in media. And they brought him over to Channel 13 and said, now you're going to do a television show. And so that's what I mean about the show was a door that a lot of people were walking through for the first time, bringing talents that they had nurtured in other spaces because they had been excluded largely from television.
How did Ellis come up with the concept that the program would be more than just music? It would encompass the whole arts scene in New York City.
Yeah, I think that has a bunch of different roots. Actually, from the point of view of public broadcasters in mm-hmm. the 1960s, people still called it educational television, not public television. And the idea was that you were supposed to turn on the TV and you were the student and the TV was the teacher. And so for people who worked in public broadcasting at the time, putting pop music on educational television was kind of anathema because they thought, well, that's like what commercial TV does. We don't do that. So, in fact, pressing against the notion that you just had to have a bunch of boring talking heads was revolutionary, like aesthetically, for a television show in its time. But I think what he wanted to do, and he was a Ellis Hazlip was a fascinating and kind of brilliant person, and he had grown up attending the segregated schools in Washington, D.C., and by segregated, I mean to say that there was a tradition of black schooling in Washington, D.C. that was very respected. He went to Howard University. So he had this kind of middle-class background, and he was a person who kind of knew everyone and was interested in everything. So his tastes were very democratic, meaning didn't just like, you know, kind of soul music or pop music. He liked gospel, and he liked gospel at a time when a lot of young folks were kind of turning away from gospel as their parents' music, and it didn't seem as politically engaged in 1968 as, say, R&B or soul or funk. He was interested in ballet. He was interested in opera. So he was interested in the whole gamut of black expression. And I think he wanted to put that on television to give people a chance to see it and to make a connection between viewers who were being underserved, who didn't have access to any of this stuff, and performers who were sometimes being underserved, because the only black performers who could get on television in those days were really the superstars who had substantial mainstream recognition. So he was interested in getting people on TV who either didn't have that recognition, although they might have been popular among black consumers, like, let's say, Curtis Mayfield and the Impressions. But he also wanted to put on, you know, concert pianist that most folks wouldn't have heard of, mm-hmm. because he thought that that was important to expose people to. I don't think he thought of exposure in kind of a, you need to know this because it's good for you to eat your vegetables kind of way. I think he was saying, you know, people ought to know that black people are doing these things. People ought to know and you don't have to love this, but you might be interested in this. You might find this, his keyword was meaningful. You might find this meaningful. And we're going to show you all of it, and we're going to ask you to think about all of it together. So you're going to have to think about the diversity, not only of black people, but of black expression in culture.
Yeah, I understand. If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny O. Hanson, Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio. And we're speaking with Dr. Gail Wall, professor of English and American Studies at George Washington University and author of It's Been Beautiful, Soul and Black Power Television. Dr. Wall, it's interesting how you came up with the title.
Yeah. It's Been Beautiful is a phrase that Ellis Hazlip liked to say.
Right.
Often when he was signing off or when he was finishing up an interview with someone. And I should say that he, in addition to bringing on all this culture, he brought on the show a variety of intellectuals and political figures, mm-hmm. including, you know, just a whole variety. And it was so It's Been Beautiful was a phrase that he used a lot. And the phrase struck me as so suggestive, first of all, because of the way that people were using the word beautiful in the late 60s. I don't know if people still use the word beautiful exactly today. Young kids still use that word the same way. But, you know, kind of how evocative beautiful was as a code word for, I think, for community and for a kind of hopeful vision of a better future that people were working for. But I also think that it's been beautiful. It's something that he said toward the end of the show when it had been defunded basically by the federal government. And I think it has this elegiacal ring to it as well. And it suggests that, you know, maybe it's been beautiful and maybe it's going to end, but maybe it'll be beautiful in the future. So there's something really evocative about it that's kind of only become more evocative since the book was published and since it was in production. You know, even the way I think about that title has changed.
Ellis somewhat described the program using the word vibration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he liked the concept of vibrations too. And the first place where I ever saw him use the word vibration was when he was describing his memories of being a child and going to the National Mall in Washington, D.C. to see the opera singer Marian Anderson sing in front of the Lincoln Memorial. This was in 1939 on Easter Day. She had been denied a stage at D.A.R. Constitution Hall in D.C. because it was a segregated facility, and Eleanor Roosevelt and other people had intervened and created the opportunity for Marian Anderson to be on the Mall to give this public concert. And he went to that, and he remembered that being, even when he was a kid and didn't quite understand it, like a transformative experience, because here he was living in D.C., and yet as a black child in D.C., he knew that there were, you know, there were all these symbols in D.C. that didn't quite belong to him. And he felt that being on the National Mall, the vibrations of the music, you know, something about the feeling that it produced in listeners, and the connection that it was, you know, the connection between listeners and performers and audience members and other audience members, all that that goes on at any kind of meaningful art event, he felt like that changed the space, that for that moment of the concert, those vibrations made the capital city into a place where he felt like he belonged. And I think he wanted to take he wanted to think about the TV show Soul as doing that for television, that for this hour once a week, you know, that there was something special that was happening, some kind of energy that was being exchanged between, you know, the image and the sounds on television and what was going on in the, you know, in the minds, the hearts, and in the skin of the people who were listening and watching. And so he hoped that it would be transformative and maybe open up possibilities of television.
As you say that, I happened to actually, during the research, run across the list of the Soul programs, and I'm looking at the premiere episode, September 12, 1968, and the guests were Barbara Atkins, Patti LaBelle and the Bluebells, Ellis' good friend Novella Nelson, Billy Taylor, The Vibrations and Pearl Williams Jones, Ivan C. Watson, and it was hosted by Alvin Poussin. That's a very cross section of African American entertainment.
Totally, and they had you, Alvin Poussin, for people who have forgotten, is the renowned psychologist, mm-hmm. psychiatrist. I might be misspeaking. They public television, and I was privileged to be able to speak to him about it. You know, he was a kind of figure of educational television, a kind of incredibly respected academic, mm-hmm. and. I think the people at the managers at the public television station were worried that we're putting all this stuff on, but we need a kind of traditional figure of public television to kind of bring it all together. And he spoke, you know, kind of warmly, remembering that he was okay at the interviews, but he was not the guy, you know, it was not his forte to say, you know, and now we're going to hear Patti LaBelle and the Bluebells. But he was an academic and an activist. So anyway, yeah, it shows you it had gospel, it had comedy, it had, and they didn't do too much comedy, but they had comedy, they right. did, they had gospel, they had, you know, I girl group music, Philadelphia sound music, so all kinds of stuff. And Novella Nelson, who is this uncategorizable performer who's never been a household name, right. but who is one of these figures kind of who's been a working musician in New York for her whole life and mm-hmm. partly is in a household name, not because she doesn't have talent, but because she doesn't fit neatly into any of the boxes. And she was doing a cabaret show and she had appeared on Broadway, so she sings also on the first show.
Why do you believe Soul has not been included in the history of public television, but also in the history of African Americans television?
Well, I think for the history of African Americans in television, people tend to look at the networks when there used to be three. Now there's more, obviously. But people tend to think about, you know, the major TV shows on the networks, which, to be honest, reached bigger audiences.
Okay.
And could be seen, you know, when people watched The Jeffersons, everyone saw it at the same time, no matter where you were.
Gotcha.
And the experience of public television was a little bit different because shows, you know, aired at different times in different markets, even though the shows were national. So I think some of those exclusions have to do with, well, it's just easier for scholars to talk about some of those shows, and more people remember Sanford and Son than remember Soul because it had a bigger audience. So I think it has partly to do with the ways that we don't remember public broadcasting. And I think partly it may have something to do with the fact that the show you know, never, it didn't, it hasn't had this commercial afterlife, you know. Everyone knows about Soul Train, and partly we know about Soul Train because there's documentaries about it, and there's, you know, like, there's a lot of nostalgia around it. And Soul Train actually started just after Soul, and Don Cornelius, the host of Soul Train, and Ellis Hazlip were friends and comrades. They had, those shows had different, you know, different target audiences and different, you know, different aesthetics, different things of what they were doing. You know, but we remember the kind of teen show. People have a real fond nostalgia about that. I think Soul was a more aesthetically challenging show, and it doesn't, you know, it doesn't fit into some of the nostalgia narratives.
Throughout Soul's lifetime, it was always a battle, struggle with funding. The Ford Foundation initially funded the program, but then the second season, it kind of somewhat reneged, but I don't know if Channel 13 picked up the funding for that second season or not.
Yeah, so the show always got some funding from Channel 13, but it always needed more funding. And even in those years, in the, let's say, the early 70s, it was pretty expensive, $20,000 a program to produce. So more expensive than like a news show where you, you know, had some producers, but you didn't have to hire the talent and the stage managers, and the lighting was simpler, that kind of thing. And it struggled. So you're right, the first year was funded by Ford. And after that, monies were scrapped together. At some point, there was hope that Mobil Oil was going to underwrite Soul. That never happened. They ended up underwriting a show called Masterpiece Theater, and the rest of that is history. So the station had a hard time getting corporate sponsors, and this is at a time when public broadcasting is starting to turn away from the federal government as a prime income source and move more toward, you know, what we now call subscribers or corporations. I mean, public broadcasters didn't do that because they loved corporations more. They did that because there were no reliable streams of federal funding. So anyway, this was a time when, you know, there was still money coming from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which is the organization that funnels those federal funds to different stations. But when the CPB, as it's called, decided that Soul was no longer interesting to it, that was the end of Soul. It couldn't sustain itself, or there was no, you know, a combination of it couldn't be sustained, and Channel 13 maybe didn't have the will to kind of make hard choices around, you know, holding on to Soul.
Dr. Gail Wall, professor of English and American Studies at George Washington University and author of It's Been Beautiful, Soul, and Black Power Television. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at jhanson@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Remember to like us on Facebook and to follow us on Twitter. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O'Hanson Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.